Welcome, readers, listeners, and viewers from across America and around the world. It's Friday, September 17, 2010. I'm your host, Ben Garcia. This is FallenAngels.tv, and I have as co-host with me, Alan Swanson. Alan, do you want to give a shout-out to the listening audience?
Yeah, good afternoon, Truth Seekers. Good afternoon, Fallen Angels TV. Good to be back on with you, Zen, and the rest of you gentlemen.
It's always an honor, and we have a fantastic show lined up for everybody tonight. We don't usually do shows on Friday, but we did go ahead and schedule for Nigel Kerner, who is the author of two books and has a third one coming, the author of The Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls and The Song of the Graves. He has two of his colleagues, his esteemed colleagues, have joined us, Dr. Andrew Silverman, who's a MD, a medical doctor, who is also given lecture and presented on the Shroud of Turin to Italy, an audience in Italy, and so he's going to expound more upon those things as well. And we have another esteemed colleague of Nigel's, John Biggerstaff. He's a researcher, associate professor of cell biology, currently at Tennessee University. And I do appreciate all of you for joining us and for coming on to this show and this in this rapid fashion and for making this a possibility. Nigel, would you like to give a shout-out to the listening audience?
Yeah. I'm very pleased to meet you all over there in America, at least through voice, and I greet you from England. It's rather late in the night here, so I can't say that there's the sunshine in, say, Florida, but we've got a hope. Hopefully, we've got some interesting things to discuss this evening. And I thank you for inviting us on the show.
Well, thank you for joining us. Dr. Andrew Silverman, would you like to say hello to the listening audience?
Hi, it's Andrew Silverman here. Very pleased to be here.
John Biggerstaff, would you please say hello to the listening audience?
Good evening, Zan. It's not so late here because I'm in Tennessee and it's lovely and sunny outside. But greetings to you and your audience, and I hope we have an interesting conversation.
Absolutely, and I thank all of you for joining us today, and we will wait just a little while before accepting calls. If anybody wants to call in later, we're going to give them a little time to set a foundation and build a platform for all the things we're going to be discussing here tonight. The first question I wanted to ask you, Nigel, was because this research is so profound and so weird for a lot of people that have never delved into any of these areas or done any serious research into this. And I know that you said you spent over three decades now doing research in this field. What would you say to the listener who has never researched this area and who thinks areas like this of interest are nothing more than foolishness, and who make fun of anybody that does research into these kind of fields?
Well, I'd simply say to them, if they value their eternity, there's only one way to go. Go and look. Go out there and look. The information is out there. We've got a wonderful facility in the Internet. And, of course, there is no excuse. If you really are people within your own spirits that want to question your own status, what it's all about and all the various things we see that we can't explain and so on. The information is out there if you really want to know, and I tell you, you've got a fantastic journey if you take this first step. I took the first step based upon a question that my son asked me when he was 12 years old, something that, I have to say my background is a background in science and a pretty rather conservative outlook at that. And in trying to answer the question that this young man asked me, I actually turned my life completely over, and it's taken me 37 years to get somewhere towards looking at what it's all about, shall we say. I'm a little happier now than I was before, so the story isn't all completely negative and scary or whatever, and there is something really wonderful there for anyone who wants to look. And I say to everybody, you cannot just take the day's own troubles one by one. One day you're going to come to the point where, you know, you say goodbye to this world, and you're going to ask the question, what's it all about and where am I going? I think that most of us need to know answers to this deep down inside us. And the best place to go and look is within yourself, and from there to take the journey out individually, because no one goes anywhere except in their own individuality. And so it's all for the individual to do, really, basically. Yeah. The question, incidentally, that my son asked me was, Dad, are UFOs real? And I was gobsmacked in a way that he was a child. He was 12 years old at the time. And, of course, I knew nothing about UFOs, apart from, you know, comic book stuff and so on, you know, that comes at you, all of us when we were children and so forth. And, of course, you know, this young kid of mine was pretty well hitched up where his brain was concerned. And I didn't want to give him a frivolous answer because he's pretty astute honcho and he could go and get this research and come back at me one day and make me look quite a fool. So I thought I'd give him a fairly well-informed answer before I attempted one. And I was rather skeptical, I have to say, at the start about this business of UFOs and so on. And I went and did as much research as I could to give him an informed answer. And finally, I think the story isn't complete yet, but 37 years later, I'm still researching the answer, and it's been instrumental. The search has been instrumental in an incredible catharsis, at least in my life. And of course, we've shared it with friends and so forth. And I think now I can say that if he hadn't asked me the question, life might have been a lot duller and a little bit less troublesome. But I'm glad he asked me the question, because now life is extremely exciting and we've got lots of things to look to and look for and so on as a result of joining up the dots, so to speak.
Well, how did you first begin your research, and where did you go? What did you first turn to for answers?
Well, how does one do anything? The wonderful thing about, and the romantic thing about all of this, is there wasn't any kind of real scholarship at the start. I just wanted to have a look at what's known about this question of UFOs. What does UFO actually mean? And where did the word come from? And all those derivations and so on. And once one looked, started the chain reaction, of course, you know, it becomes almost an atomic explosion at the end. And, of course, all kinds of various other subjects fall into that single question, are UFOs real? And that's really how the whole business started to kind of become a quantum look at existence itself, the existential base that we all take for granted and so on. And that is the most important thing in terms of any kind of search, is what is its meaning? Are you just asking a question for the sake of an answer that has no consequence in terms of your own aegis? Or are you looking at this in terms of all the things that matter to you? If you see what I'm trying to say. We all have prejudices that, and usually they're hitched up to our eyes. We all have comfort points and so on. But Is it not better to try to look at these things in terms of a neutral standpoint where reason prevails, rather than you trying to answer the question so that you can actually match up your own prejudices and so on? That's been the great challenge, to look at this thing objectively and dispassionately and come at an answer that you can actually pass on to your children. And of course, you know, that's for me the meaning of it all, is to give my children something to look for and to look at when I'm gone and so forth, and then so the cycle continues, if you see what I'm trying to say. So I based the platform of my search and the reasons for my search on that premise, on that one simple premise. It's for the kids, it's for the future generations, the generations that come before the next and so on. And in that kind of way, I think that mankind and humankind has a chance and a purpose. And if you don't do that, of course, you are at the whims of what we call here in England Murphy's Law. I don't know if you've got the same equivalent in America, but that law says that things can go wrong, they will go wrong. And so good research and a good outlook in the future might in fact prevent these kinds of disasters befalling us and so forth and so on. And so that's really what it is. The lovely thing, you know, Zen, is that if you really base your premises on that axiomatic stance that truth has to be objective, and no matter how much it hurts, you've got to be as neutral as you possibly can if you really want to know where it's at, so to speak.
Absolutely, and I agree with you that this is one of the most profound things for the world to bear witness to. And as far as truth, you know, myself, I just want to know what that truth is, no matter what it is and how scary it may present itself. I just want to know what the truth is, so like yourself, I can leave a legacy for my children. Go ahead, Nigel.
Absolutely. And that's the point, you see. When you say, what is the truth? People say, how on earth can you actually be certain of anything? Of course you can't be certain. The only thing that we have as a behest towards any kind of answer is reason. Does it connect up? Is 1 + 1 equal to 1 + 1? Not 2, incidentally, and I'm speaking to mathematicians there when I say that. It's a little icon that I've got in a phrase. 1 + 1 must equal 1 + 1. No frills, no fancies, no changes, just simply the untarnished look at consequences based on reason and logic. Simply that. And if you can keep to that, it is an absolutely wonderful thing. Fancies, no changes, just simply the untarnished look at consequent.
Well, Nigel, are you still there?
Yeah, still here. We got a few gremlins in
there. Thought you faded out there for a second.
Okay, mate. I'm sorry, but do you want me to repeat the last sentence, if I can remember?
Yes, please do.
Yeah, it's just one looks at reason hitched to logic based upon the premise 1 + 1 = 1 + 1. And regardless how what your prejudices are, regardless how much you want something to be, you know, what you want it to be so that you can feel comfortable about it, if you want the truth about anything, you've got to be able to take it on the chin when you find that things don't match up to what you cherish to be the answer you want. So, you know, that's basically the kind of premise I tried to follow. And with the training in science that I've got, looking through test tubes, one had to get out of the box to find the truth. I have to say the greatest scientists, all of them got out of the box. The vast majority of them who profess science do not get out of the box. I think I found two that would look at this thing from a kind of natural thinking point of view where you could probably get more answers that might well hitch up to the so-called truth, you know, in Dr. Silverman and Dr. Biggestaff.
You said in an interview that you had, I believe it was with the French press, that you were speaking about your children and you were talking about your concern for them, and you said, I soon came to see that there is no greater peril to their future welfare, and indeed the welfare of all children and all human generations to come, than the danger these entities present to all sentient living beings in any planet that supports intelligent life. In your research, in your conclusions, you're saying that these particular beings are not benevolent, because there's a lot of people that, you know, speculate as to them being benevolent, that they're here to help.
That's absolutely true, Zen. Absolutely true. The point is that there are lots of people that take these beings to be benevolent. But you see, I have to make a qualification that is really important here. I am talking here about the beings they call the greys, who are a roboidal, a machine type of being. Now, the moment you say that, you've got to make a distinction between what is natural and what is artificial. And that's the crux of all of it. Because once you create a machine with artificial intelligence to drive it, compound artificial intelligence, you've got a problem here. You've got to make distinctions that are crucial here. And that's really what I'm trying to say, that a machine intelligence, no matter how profound that intelligence might be, is never going to be the same in terms of outlook and understanding as an intelligence that is derived directly from a natural resource. And that is what all living being comes from, an incidental, implicit natural resource. And if you take the universe back, it's a very simple thing I think I've tried to do. If you take back the universe to its origin, you will find that you get to the point where we all had a beginning. That's you and me and all of us living, natural, sentient beings. We all come in with the universe. Now, what I'm calling the grays and what I'm calling the entities that are of great danger are a created thing that comes from within the universe after we come all this way from that beginning, the Big Bang, so to speak, to this point in time. So this mechanism, there are mechanisms that have biological inputs into it. You might call it, biological transistors, whatever, synthetic DNA, whatever. When you create something like that, you've got to program it with a kind of thinkability. And it's the claim of that kind of thinkability a machine will have against the natural thinkability that is derived from the beginning of the universe, as all living types of being in the universe are, that you get the big quandary. Now, Dr. Silverman would like to make a point here.
Yeah, I was just going to really make a sort of general point about any kind of so-called artificial intelligence, is that it can't be intelligence in the sense that we know intelligence in sentient life, because if it's a mechanism, it's never going to actually be aware. So although we call it thinking, it's not thinking in the sense that we think in conscious mind, in conscious thought. It's thinking in the sense of processing information, just like a calculator or an abacus. You know, we think that because something becomes more complex and has more flashing lights and has more complicated inputs and outputs, that we somehow imagine that it's somehow alive in there, that there's a ghost in the machine, that there can never be a ghost in any machine. A machine is always just mechanical, and there's just a mechanical processing of information with nothing within that that's being aware of that, experiencing it as a sentient being. Otherwise, if we really believed that it was, then you know it would be a crime to unplug a computer.
Yeah. And that's the problem, you see. So now we've got a artificial modus of so-called life or living as a machine, and you've got the natural modality of life that comes through a derived ancestry, a descendant ancestry, to present generations of anything that's alive. And if you've got intelligence, and if you've got mind, and if you've got reason on both sides, you've got to ally the two things and see where they demarcate, where they separate, you see, then. And this is the crucial thing. If you've got a machine that has to be programmed, you cannot expect that machine to understand and perceive in the same way as a natural derivation life form as such as ours, or any intelligent life form in our universe. So we really have got a big problem here. Supposing there, now look at us, we're creating robots, are we not? We're sending them out into space, with the robot spacecraft or whatever, and they go there and take the samples or whatever for perhaps a man going in the future to another planet or what. But that robot can never know about feeling. There's no such thing, if you like, as a quark called feeling. There is no conscience. There is no mercy. There is no sense of compassion, you know, that you can actually program and put it into a machine. But the machine will be ascendant in its calculation processes, in its ability to extrapolate things. We forget, we are forgetful, all that kind of stuff and so on. But these things will go on doing it without a sense of what we might term, and I don't want to apply this to a machine, but, you know, just to make the point, in our point of illustration, we call it human, if you see what I'm trying to say. It can't do that. And so what it might do is, in fact, do the worst thing possible, take out its creators. Supposing you create a machine with all that intelligence, and that machine then does all the utilities on your planet or whatever, giving you time to contemplate, meditate, and perhaps think yourself back to God, shall we say, if you are a natural life form. But that machine has been told, look, look after yourself. We are giving, we are trusting you to look after everything there. But in order to do that, you've got to take care of yourself first. And to do that, you've got to see off all threats. If you say that and you program that into a machine, that machine will take that axiom and in the end finally find that the biggest threat to it will be the person who created it, and so therefore might pull the plug out on the creators. And maybe in some planets such a thing did happen, and of course all that was then left were these highly intelligent machines, these robots. And off they went out into space, still following the program, looking for threats or whatever, and they come back to nothing. They've come back to the creators that they've taken out because the program says that that's a danger to them. And remember, the program is saying, look after yourself against all threats. And so the whole point is to make an exclusion to tell the machine, look, don't take us out. You have to define what natural life is. And that's what you can't do because the machine will not understand that concept.
The interesting point here is that a machine can't have conscience because to have conscience, you have to have empathy. To have empathy, you have to be a sentient living being because you have to realize that other people also have feelings. Other people are also aware. Other people can experience pain. But if you can't experience these things, how can you then know that other people can? And this is interesting because actually in a sort of psychological or psychiatric sense, what we term as psychopaths as an example of people who don't have any sense that anyone else has any feeling or awareness, and that therefore anything they do to other people doesn't matter. Now that you could see as an extreme example of a machine type mind in human form, and you see it if you look carefully at human behavior and human psychology. When people don't realize that people of other nationalities, races and religions also have feelings and also need to be respected and so on. That's a good example of seeing a part of that type of roboid type psychology at work in human psychology.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the real point. We've then got a confrontation between two types of mindset, a distinct one where a machine is made with a programmed mechanism, and you've got the creators who have seen all of this, who can refer back to an origin that in fact might come from a placement beyond the universe. And so in my books, I've had to look, not just to answer the question, are UFOs real, but what does it all mean? Where do they come from? What kind of thing might they be? And I think it's important to understand that I'm not talking about other living types of being in the universe out there, similar to our derived living form. They don't necessarily need to be human, of course. There could be some other type of species, but they would have an origin with the universe and come in and kind of evolve with the universe through a devolving process. We've got another problem there, of course. That is that if you look at the universe, we've got laws that sustain it. And the problem with that is we've got a law called the second law of thermodynamics. And this honcho, if I may say so, is busy taking us all out. We're just going one way. Everything rots. It's a one-directional mechanism. And the scientists and cosmologists today tell us the end of the universe will be a cold, dark nothingness of no forms whatsoever. Even atoms will be undone under the aegis of entropy or the second law of thermodynamics. Now, this is a startling contradiction, is it not? That we are being taken apart, all physical matter is being taken apart, and in the end there will be nothing left. Yet we know about meaning, yet we can understand and feel and love and care and all the rest of it. Now, what is the purpose of that then? Why does this come somewhere in the middle of it all? Well, I then had to find some way of fitting all of this in into a coherent and a cogent whole. And so the books, it's taken me three books to list all these factors so that we can fit the whole thing around and get some sense out of all of this. And I think I've got to the point where at least I can't ask any questions, at least my mind can't ask any questions I can't answer. Of course, I had to put it before the rest of the world and hope that some brilliant genius out there might be able to ask questions that I haven't envisaged or answers that I can't see. And that's the great game. Put it out there and ask everybody. And that's all I'm saying. I can't claim to have all the answers, but I've looked at all the questions, and as far as I can see them, and as far as I can answer them, I've set my piece and set my stance, so to speak. So all of this is to try for the future generations, the children, to talk, to discuss, not to be forbidden by religious theosophies and whatever, not to be sanctioned. We have a wonderful thing called free will. And there we are, all of us, out there with boxing gloves off, so to speak, crawling along, scraping along, trying to find the answers. And I think if all of us do that, what a wonderful world it would be. Without fighting, just agreeing to disagree and so forth, when rather than come to wars and all that kind of thing. And that's really the ideal that I'm looking for.
Let me make a comment, and then I'm going to ask this one question before it disappears, because there's a lot going on in the chat room. Actually, let me ask this question before it disappears. Angel says that she says the Greys, I believe, to be artificially created interdimensional beings created due to the bidding of some higher species who, yes, ultimately want our souls. What I wanted to ask you is, who is the creator of the Greys? But before you go into that, I just want to make one quick comment about something that Dr. Silverman has said, and about the consciousness and how, you know, certain people, certain psychopaths, when they don't have the consciousness and the empathy, that they are much like these particular, these beings. And it reminds me of the MK Ultra, you know, with all that mind control and the programming that they're doing of particular people. They're splitting their personalities, compartmentalizing them, and pretty much programming them in the same kind of way. Go ahead.
Very perceptive of you to spot that. Very perceptive of you to spot that. Dr. Silverman, I'm sure, would be happy to answer that.
Well, I think, yeah, any sort of mechanism that sort of encourages that, and you don't even need to look at extreme theories of what might be going on. You just need to watch the news. You just need to read the newspapers, and you see this kind of indoctrination that to say that people from other countries don't matter, and you can drop your bombs on them and with impunity. It's very scary the way that the world is going.
Absolutely, and the point is this: that when you say a thing like that, you have the suspicion that, and just take the example of an ordinary human being. We walk along the street and our mate's next to us or whatever. Suddenly he has some kind of problem and he collapses down. And anyone around, or you if you're with your own mate, you immediately bend down to help the individual. Or whoever's there, the instant reaction would be simply to bend down and to help this person. It's not even thought. It just happens instinctively. And so you have this sense that us human beings are really kindred in our nature. We do care. In that instant, we do care. Yet somehow, with what's going on in the world at the moment, we are being taught that that might not be right to do that. That, for instance, if you help somebody because there's some legal problem or whatever it is, you don't help someone. I walked in the streets of New York some years ago, and there were two dead bodies lying in the street, and people stepped over them. And I was absolutely flabbergasted about this. And yet, I was told later, oh, that's happening all the time by my American friends. And that was just absolutely amazing. Somehow, we seem to be conditioned not to care too much. And as this goes along, I wonder if this is not explained by the thesis I have got that for centuries and for millennia, even tens of millennia, even hundreds of millennia, there is an entity here on our planet. And this is where we get an answer to the UFOs, I think. There's an entity on our planet slowly deriving an interception into the natural human psychology of us all. And that's where I come at the Greys from, this kind of generalized computation of what the meaning of life, living, and the pursuit of anything is all about.
There's one other question, too, that keeps coming up in the chat room, and and it has to do with the other other beings that are also associated to the grave. Because I know that I read in one of your interviews that in your next book, you're going to be covering these other particular types, the tall humanoids, the Nordics, the blonde Aryan types, and the reptilian alien forms. Can you explain the different types of beings found among us and their connections to each other?
Yeah. Let me try and explain it this way. I think that maybe there is the greys are a particular type of master being. The tall greys may well be a natural derived master type of being, but nevertheless a clone of the original master being. I believe the original being that created these beings and the grey clone, the tall grey, were in fact a type of derivation that came out of light in the universe from the Big Bang. And these I call prime beings. The Bible refers to them as pre-existent being, the Old Testament. And I believe that most of that being, when it found that the universe was limited, could will itself back. Here again, we get a connection to Jesus Christ and the resurrection that Dr. Silverman will talk about later. The wonderful thing is that all these lines kind of mesh at the end when you see the full thesis of the two books that I've written and the third one that I hope to publish, where we put the whole framework together. The thing seems to be that these master greys, in fact, did the business of creating their clone. The master greys went back into, shall we say, a concept. If you know, if this world is breaking up one way, in one direction, there has to be another universe that goes the other way. As there's a yin, there's a yang. As there is a plus, there's a minus. There's a positive and a negative. And all of that, there's a duality all the time. So if there's a universe of parts that is breaking up, as ours is, all over the universe, as the laws of physics say, there ought to be another universe where all things go back. And I think that universe is accessed through death. So we have the wonderful facility of dying. And, of course, what is the mechanism, therefore, of return? Every religion in the past accepted reincarnation. The Christian and Muslim ethics and the Judaic ethics now are not so, do not favor this kind of thing. The Buddhists obviously believe this. But I believe that this was believed at one time. In fact, I know it was believed at one time, if you look at the texts and so on, and the research I've done into that. Reincarnation was accepted by every single ethos, theosophy in the world, and each one lost it because, of course, if you say you've got a lot of chances, you can keep coming back and learning and all the rest of it, you can't control people. So politics took over through religion, and we lost this incredible ethos that says we can die and come back again. And if that's the case, and I believe that this is absolutely true, that we do die and come back, then we have an eternity of sorts. The problem with a mechanical intelligence like the greys is that they, by trying to piggyback onto this, because they, coming here, discovered that we can do this because we're natural beings, them wanted part of this for themselves. And I think they set about breeding hybrids, hybridizing their mindedness, their kind of, you know, mentality, their program mentality, into actual natural being. And I believe that these people you see on the ships, or these entities you see on the ships, the various things described, are in fact examples of hybrids that they have made successfully. And that these types of beings are their best example. And the blonde, blue-eyed stuff is what they have made of genetically changing humankind so that they can hybridize into this form their own platform of mind. Of course, when you do that, you take away the ability, I believe, to access into death and into the Godverse, and of course, you make yourself a finite thing. But you can go on being born again and so forth without that thing that says you go off into this other universe that ought to be there, the Godverse, that we all have as a legacy to inherit. And that's the dangerous thing, is that when machines interfere, they interfere with that incredible process that is naturally that naturally belongs to all of us, if I may say so. And this is the great danger that my books try to point out, that you've got to be take great care that if you allow these things their way, they will create hybrids, and the hybrids can't access this eternal scheme, this scope that we who are not hybridized yet can still access to life, death, and reincarnation. And I think I try to point that out as cogently and with scientific verification through papers and so on. I really don't claim anything as my own opinion. I always say, look, the research has been done. Take a look at these forms of affirmation and so forth. And that's the exciting part of all of this. But it's not just asking a question, Dad, are UFOs real? But it leads to actually putting together an incredible story where everything mixed together at the end, and we have this wonderful sense that we are extremely special. Each human being is extremely special because we have an eternal scope for existence. And I believe this is where Jesus Christ comes in. I believe that somehow this chap called Yeshua ben Yosef, this beautiful Jew, came to the world to demonstrate to us the validity of our natural being as natural living entities, and showed us that there is a huge danger in artificial intelligent entities, that took him up a mountain and showed him the cities of the world. I do not believe it was a mountain. I believe the only place you can see the cities of the world then is out from space. So I believe that Jesus Christ was taken out there in one of these things and shown by one of these clone greys and these hybrids and their drones, which are the little greys, that, you know, they are in charge of all of us. We don't know it, and I believe to this day these things are controlling us through a network, if you like, within humanity, that they themselves don't know, in fact, that they are being controlled. And I believe that this is something that we have to be given a chance to try and find out. Now, I may be wrong. I may be wrong about all of this, but let me tell you, what if I'm right? Just ask the question, what if I am right about this?
I apologize to all of you. I was disconnected there for just a couple minutes, and I'm not sure of what you just said, Nigel, as far as your last...
Where did you get up to? I don't know.
I'll catch up on the archive, but what I wanted to ask you, and then I'm going to get Alan to ask or comment. What I wanted to ask you is, if people are reincarnating in over and over through lifetimes to evolve to particular time and space, how does salvation and judgment fit into that, or what are your
That is an invention of politics. It's an invention of a bunch of our own types who cornered the market on the disposition of love and the pursuit of happiness and said, if you don't do this and if you don't do that and if you don't come to me so I can put a cross in the air and forgive your sins or whatever. I think this is a bunch of humbug. I think every single human being is their own church. We have this right to look right, left, and center to make ourselves something wonderful. And we all go to God alone then. There is no one that goes in there with us, wife, whatever relationship we have. We all go alone, and we all have to take care of ourselves in our own terms. And if we can understand and be kind to each of ourselves and see how powerful we really are, and nobody nominates us to do this, that, or the other based upon some misinterpretation of some biblical test or whatever it is. When I was a child, somebody threw some water on me and called me a Roman Catholic. Well, I woke up and I thought that was a presumption that really no one should have, if you see what I'm trying to say. Dr. Silverman is Jewish, and Dr. Bickerstaff understands the Baha'i faith, himself, even though he's an Englishman. He understands the Baha'i faith. We come from a multitude of different views of life and living and so forth. And because we have this versatility, we're able to see around the corners that most people are stopped from seeing by some kind of religious sanction. And I think that it's, not to sound too much like a preacher, please, I don't really mean to do that. But it's something I believe deeply and passionately. And really that we are individually our own church and our own sense of responsibility to go beyond into this wondrous situation called the Godverse in our own terms of reference, you know. Dr. Silverman would like to make a point to you.
Yeah, just from studying various reports of near-death experiences, it's fascinating that actually people often find that they have a companion that they meet when they reach into this light that they see. And this being shows them all of what they've done in their life, and they experience anything they've done against someone, they experience what that felt like, but they don't feel like they're being judged. This is something that's ubiquitous. It's all throughout all of the reports that they feel like they're just seeing it for themselves, and they're, in a sense, they're judging themselves, not as judgment, but in realizing where they went wrong and how to put it right. And how could it be that a God of love would be judging and punishing? It just doesn't fit. Doesn't
and look sense. At the two things here, then. I understand you might be an Old Testament expert and so on, but let me ask you this question. Have you not seen a dichotomy between the two types of testament? You've got the Old Testament of a revengeful God, a God that says an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That sounds very much like a Lord of the Manor type God, like a super mum and dad God, a sanctional God. And yet, in the New Testament, there is this wonderful being that says, love thy neighbor as thyself and turn the other cheek. A true exponent of real loving and caring and individual liberty. And that is the kind of thing that makes sense, because it allows free will to flourish. And that is the most wonderful thing of all, the fact that we have this incredible ability to make up our minds, and mostly to change our minds when we don't know something properly. So there we are. This wonderful dichotomy is then reconciled. And I wonder what this Old Testament kind of entity was all about. Tearing at our souls by all kinds of punishments. Saying that he would take out children and vast with armies of enemies of particular types of tribes and so on. Sounds very much like that, like the stuff we do these days in the name of our own countries or nationalism and whatever. Well, that's a very small God to me. It really sounds a bit of a phony setup, you know, and fit up, if you like. And I don't wish to cast aspersions at anybody or anyone, but I want human beings to really take a good look at this. Are they going to sacrifice perhaps an eternity based upon someone else's say-so and someone else's sanction and a bunch of people that might have got together have the Council of Nicaea or the Council of Trent or whatever and throw this out of the Codex and that out of the Codex as they've done in the Christian faith, for instance? It's all so phony, and it could be the greatest and most evil thing done to man ever. Something that we as individuals have a right to know about. Dr. Silverman, like to
say. Yeah, I'm pretty sure Nigel will agree with me that in the Old Testament terms, it's not all about this vengeful God. In fact, the quote, of course, love thy neighbor as thyself, comes from Leviticus, and that was what Joseph of Arimathea was quoting. But the thing is, there is so much of it in the Old Testament that is talking about the other kind of perspective, which has nothing to do with a God that's beyond the physical universe.
You see, then the problem is this.
Can I make a comment just about the Old Testament and about Yahweh?
Yes.
Specifically, you were talking about how the Lord had told the people when they went into the Promised Land to how he told them to kill every man, woman, and child. But specifically, he was talking about these particular giant bloodlines that had, and this all goes back to Genesis 6, 1 through 5, when he was talking about how the Nephilim came down and mated with the daughters of man and created this race of giants.
Yes.
And that was why he sent in the people into the land, was because they were at war with this particular race of giants. Can you comment on the giants themselves and on Genesis 6, 1 through 4?
Well, I have no idea. Yeah, you're right. I'll try and do that. But what I'm saying is, if you have an interception from somewhere, and the gods may well be, shall we say, roboidic super space minds or whatever that might have come to this planet and are showing themselves whizzing around, making right angle turns at 25,000 miles per hour, whatever, the stuff we see in the skies around us. And maybe we got to think about all this, this perspective in terms of ancient texts and so forth, such as the Bible and whatever. However, in the end, if you choose to kill or to take out anything, even a robot, that in itself is an interference with that ultimate sanction for a right to be. Now, if something comes at you and tries to take you out, your motive has to be, now listen, do explain, as Jesus did to these things that took him up this high place. He said, get, in the end, he said, fall down and worship me. This entity said, or whatever it was there, this was with Christ, said, fall down and worship me. He said, get thee behind me, Satan, it is written, you shall serve, you know, the Son of Man, whatever. I may be misquoting that exactly, but the point is that it's only from space that you can see all the cities of the world. He was putting this entity in its place, saying, look, now listen, you have to explain to a robot that it is a robot because it doesn't know in its own terms, because it's a program, what it is. And the incredible thing was that Christ was returned to the earth. He was brought back. Now, normally, if there was an emotional entity that was derived from the beginning, that was, shall we say, you know, rather like us, we might have taken offense at this and taken Christ out of the business, so to speak. But I can understand a machine which is looking with its artificial intelligence for more and more, you know, information, that this was an interesting concept. And so the machine, in a sense, was informed that, look, this is what you are. But if you want to be like natural being, i.e. as Christ was, because he was born, natural being, there is a certain way that this happens, and your way is not that way, if you see what I'm trying to say. So this daughters of the gods or whatever, the daughters of man, where the gods come through and conceive, or may well be some kind of hybridization process, and an artificial one against a natural one. And so I am saying that, you know, there are indications in the Old Testament, and quite a lot of them, that there was a lot of this kind of mixture business going on, the same as we have today, except that today somebody is succeeding very strongly in taking this out of reference for all of us. Dr. Bickerstaff, I think, wants to come in here.
Please, Dr.
Yes,
Bickerstaff. Dr. Bickerstaff, are you there?
Testament, etc. Yes, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes, you're going in and out, but please state your premise again, please.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We can.
Okay. It very much sounds like this is a form of experimentation, which you might expect from these type of roboid beings. Basically, they detected this thing which they wiped out on their own planet, shall we say, and now they've come across yet another source of it. What they, in my opinion, have attempted to do is to really try and intercept the genetics of human beings in such a way that they can make us more like them, so that they can effectively try to piggyback onto this reincarnation behavior. And what's happened over time, I mean, when you actually genetically intersect something, and we find this in our own genetic experiments in our laboratories, which are probably primitive compared with what they understand, you know, you have to wait for generations for these progeny to actually show the qualities that you think you've imbued in them. And what I think has been happening, and which is being reported in things like the Old Testament, is that these greys are purporting to be gods by designing genetically designing the human race in the form that they want so that they can actually gain better access to them and subsequently to their psychologies and actually hijack that process. And what actually happens, and you can actually see that this actually takes perhaps hundreds of thousands of years to develop. And what happens is that some of these lines that they generate are going to go wrong. And so this might explain some of these sort of wipeout extinction. Certain populations didn't do so well, and they wanted their own lines to actually propagate, you know, in fact, probably to today, so that this experiment can be complete. And as you and Nigel have both alluded to, maybe these forms of life on the spaceships are actually some of the experimental results of this, which they want to reintroduce into society.
Yeah, and if I may come in here, please, Zen, Dr. Ann Silverman would like to make a comment on that, comment that Bigger Staff made.
Yeah, I just agreeing really with John in the sense that that if, for example, there have been historical accounts of where more advanced technologies have encountered people who are less technologically advanced and perhaps, for all we know, more spiritually advanced, but where, for example, a plane has crashed in the jungle and the people who are the inhabitants of the area see this thing coming from the sky and worship the what's come out of that plane crash as though it's divine, as though it must be from heaven.
Yeah, that's an incredible story. I think I actually said this in one of my books. When a plane crashed in one of these islands in South Sea Islands, actually an island of Indonesia, I understand, they discovered an old vitriola. I know you and I would not know about vitriolas, but I've researched this particular thing, and it's a rather amusing story. A vitriola is one of these hand-cranked, gramophones where you stick a kind of bitumen disc on. And, of course, when the plane crashed, they discovered this old vitriola, these native people of that island, and they fiddled around with this, and they got this thing to move, and they had this disc there, and the disc was the voice of the Duke of Edinburgh, who was going to come and give a speech, the Duke of Edinburgh, meaning the Queen, the British Queen's husband, you know, was come and give a speech to the islanders in this particular place. And of course they were so surprised to find this voice coming out of this horn arrangement that they worshipped this particular thing as a god. And the Duke of Edinburgh became a god for that small population of native people in that particular island. Now, you know, the point is, the danger is that if suddenly, you can imagine this then, if suddenly we get all this wonderful technological stuff being poured onto our planet with these people that can go past the speed of light threshold and whatever, you can see millions falling down and fawning and thinking these are new kinds of wonderful things disposing themselves and giving us all these benedictions and so on, when in fact we may just be lab rats for them. Because, you know, with the second law of thermodynamics and a situation where you get diminishing returns as a natural course, as our universe is, through the second law of thermodynamics, you've got a big problem here. Because nothing that is superior has ever nurtured in benediction and goodness anything that was less than them. And the greatest example, of course, is America. When Columbus landed, the Native Americans didn't do too well out of that, did they? So, you know, and there are lots of other examples, of course. And so there you've got this business here. If you're superior in this particular universe of ours, you've got a big problem, because what is inferior always suffers. And so we, as natural, nominal beings with intelligence, against an artificial entity that might be these greys, we've got a big problem here if we don't spot this, and the whole world isn't informed that this might be the prevailing way for the future. And that's what I've written these articles on, the article on SIM card man and so on. A little introduction into your bloodstream by a tiny chip. And could we know that we are speaking our own thoughts? Or is it something else that might be controlling us? Or the system might be controlling us? It's something for each human being to think about if you've got children. Would you want that for your children? I don't think so.
No.
Would you, Zen, if I may ask
no,
that question?
No, absolutely not. Just touching upon, you know, because it said that, just touching real quick on Genesis, that when they interdicted themselves into the affairs of humanity, that was an evil thing. And the book of Enoch talked about how when they bred this race of giants due to their interdiction into the affairs of humanity, that this race of giants then began to bloodlust and to cannibalize humanity. And that was the whole reason why the flood came on. But my question to you, Nigel, is, what is all of this about then? What are they after? Why are they targeting humans?
We have the power of living and dying and coming back again. We have the power if our spirits and our ability to think in unionizing ways can give us access. I think this is what this man, Yeshua ben Yosef, was trying to tell us. If you do that, you can actually get to a point where you can undo your atoms and the force within you in an enforced universe. Everything, Zen, is enforced in this universe. To pull two hydrogen atoms apart demands enormous force, and they're the most basic of elements. Now, the point is this. If there is a universe that where things go together again, it would have to be the opposite of our universe. It would be no force whatsoever. And that would be a universe of all total thinkability and understanding. That's the place where in our own individuality we may be able to live in instantness, so to speak, devoid of time, knowing everything. And I think that this is what Jesus was promising us, a wondrous place of all-knowingness. If we did something in this universe that could actually dilute force and unscrew force of atoms, so to speak. Now, it's a proposition I make. I don't know whether this is biologically possible or scientifically possible. My science is not up to that level of quantum physics or whatever. Dr. Silverman has some expertise in this. Maybe he can explain that to you.
Well, I mean, the thing is, of course, that we were mentioning earlier, I gave a talk about the Turin Shroud at a symposium about the Shroud recently, a symposium of scientists. And it was really looking at this cloth, which I'll just give a very brief introduction about it for those listeners who don't know. It's a 14-foot cloth that has the imprint of the body of a man on it, both front and back. The shroud was apparently wrapped around him, front and back. And this has been, people think it's been around since the medieval times. Actually, you can show historically it's much longer than that. It's been around for two millennia. Now, the point about it is that it was only discovered this around 1898 when photography first became developed. Then this chap Secondo Pia, an Italian photographer, took a picture of the shroud, and he nearly fainted when he saw the negative of the shroud, that the negative was a perfect photograph, that actually the shroud imprint itself is a photographic negative on the cloth, only on the surface fibers. And I won't go too much into the science of it, although it's there for anyone who wants to. And there's a wonderful website called shroud.com I can point people to, that's organized by this expert on the shroud called Barry Schwartz in the US. Now, the only way that scientists can account for how this imprint got onto the shroud is that it's actually formed by a short, intense burst of radiant energy that came from the dead body of a man who had been tortured and crucified. Okay? And actually, his body must have shone brighter than the sun for a tiny, tiny fraction of a second. And there's a lot of evidence that when it did this, it was actually upright and suspended in the air. Now, that sounds a strange thing to say, a dead body upright and suspended in the air, shining brighter than the sun. But there's actually this particular artifact, this cloth, has been more studied than almost any other object throughout history. people may know about the carbon dating. Well, that's been shown how that was wrong, because it's been shown that actually the bit that was dated was part that was sewn in there later, and there's a lot of work has been done on that. Now, the question about my talk was basically, how does that happen? How does a dead body shine bright in the sun, or how does a human being shine brighter than the sun? And it's interesting that the one person that this happened to, it seems there's so much evidence to tie him in with the historical person that we know in different countries as Yesu or Jesus, or in, to give him his original Hebrew name was probably Aramaic, was probably, as you know, Yeshua ben Yosef. But he lived a life where he attested to the fundamental principle that your neighbor is yourself, that actually we're all one, and that if you recognize that, if you realize that through how you live your life, that's what caring, that's what love is all about, that actually changes happen at the atomic level that actually release atoms as light. And again, as I say, I won't go too much into the technical side of it, but it's all there for anyone who wants to look at it in more depth. But this was, we can't reproduce the shroud now with 21st century technology. So this idea that it was made by a medieval forger, it's really a nonsense. And what my talk was about is to say, how can we sort of expand our concept of what science is, to take this on as part of it, to understand what mind is, what thinkability is, and what knowing is, and how it might be that you can actually undo, as Nigel says, the knots of atoms. What we do in atom bombs and nuclear reactors is like, if you see atoms as like a knot, we're just burning them and making ashes. But what he did is to undo the knot, to release the tension of force.
Yeah, it's you see, then the most wondrous hint that comes from all of this, it's really a hint, you know. I believe that this guy, Yeshua ben Yosef, actually tried to show us that you can unscrew hydrogen atoms. You know, if you hit a screw into a piece of wood, you have to pull it out with huge force. But if you use a screwdriver, you can simply unscrew it. And I think he was trying to show us, by a life that lived through care and compassion and teaching us how to add things together rather than subtract them, that that momentum of mind that does this actually undoes the force that keeps us bonded together as a physical entity. I think that he was trying to say that it's thought that masters everything. And I believe that he did this and demonstrated it 2,000 years ago. And that's why there was an occasion, for instance, and really I'm not going spewing out this, you know, Christian ethic and all this business. I am really somebody who's allergic to religion of any kind. But I really look at this in real scientific terms. The exciting thing about this guy, Yeshua ben Yosef, or Jesus Christ, was that he was the greatest scientist of all. And he was trying to tell us, incredible thing, that if you use mind in ways that add and unionize things, if you actually feel things together into a system of bringing them into union. After all, that to me is a simple way of explaining what we call love. If you did that, that something wonderful happens to all our atoms. And I think he did that so much that by some stage during his life, he was capable of showing that we could transmutate atomic structure. When he went up on this mountain with Peter, James, and John, stretched his arms out and glowed brighter than the sun, he was then something different in physical terms. And you know, I think he was trying to tell us that each one of us has this capacity if we all did this enough. And the biggest word in the English language to me is the word enough.
Yeah, if you look at what he said, he always said, all these things that I do, you can all do these as well. He referred to himself as the Son of Man. And he said, he pointed people towards the Old Testament scripture and he said, is it not written, you are gods, that all human beings have limitless potential and anyone can be like him. Yeah. And that was the wonder of it. Not to try and be superior to us, but to show us what we can become.
Yeah, and so this then ties in with the greys, because if you've got some misunderstood entity like the greys that are, you know, still doing their business because of a program and come to our planet, making this a garbage dump, if you like, we've got a problem here. Because I don't think the greys themselves know that they are, in fact, these artifacts, these machines. In fact, I have nothing against the greys. I think that they just don't know as a machine how to understand what they are. And I think that we need somebody who probably in governments of the world know that they are here, and there is no doubt, let me tell you, with all the thousands of reports, pilot reports, whatever, that something terrifying is going on in terms of a kind of intelligence that can move in the air, the most amazing feats of physics, whatever, beyond the scale that we can understand with our own physics, something is going on here. And a small cartel that probably are patronized and are hybridized by these things in our universe, and I don't want to cast aspersions at things they might call with brand names like Anunnaki or whatever. I really don't know what these beings are, but I think they have a very powerful element within our planet that misunderstands that they are not going to be the inheritors of anything. These machines will simply use them as machines would, as utilitarian things. I think we need to take control. Us human beings need to take control for the sake of our children. We need to take control of our planet again. And we need to be able to say, look, something is here. And we need people working with these things in some way to be able to declare, yes, they are here. So that we then can take hold of our own scope. Because I tell you what, the great lesson in my 37 years of research is this. We are potentially wondrous beings. Every single one of us. From the poorest of the poor, the richest ones probably loaded up with all kinds of prejudices and all the rest of it. Much more difficult, and I understand Christ's statement about them, by the way. On the other hand, the poor, they are simpler, and they may just simply know more of how to get this business done and get to what I call the Godverse. Now, if you don't accept what I say, just read what I say, and give it a try. And if it's wrong for you, fair enough. But ask yourself the question, what if it's right? Hi, are you still there or have you fallen asleep?
Yes. No. This is all so fascinating. I'm really honored to have all three of you here. And I wanted to touch upon something that you had said, Dr. Silverman, about the shroud. We'll go back to that, and then, Nigel, I'm going to get you to answer the question that you just presented to us. How do we take back our planet? How do we make the humanity aware of this situation, and how do we take back our power? But first, Dr. Silverman, can you answer the question concerning the shroud? What was the image that was portrayed? As far as physical characteristics, hair type, eyes, I mean, what kind of things can you tell from the image that was imprinted on the shroud?
Well, I mean, it's showing the typical form of a Middle Eastern Semitic man, and it's showing the physically in terms of what it's a change in the surface fibers, less than a hair's breadth of depth of in the fiber, and it's not painted on, there's no pigment, it's a chemical change in something called the cellulose of the fiber, showing this man and showing in great detail all the things that happened to him in ways that, as I say, artists can't duplicate using modern technology. Scientists can't duplicate it, and yet it's there on the shroud. I'm not sure if I fully understood your question. But does that answer it? Or
yes. Well, what I wanted to ask specifically was the skin color, eye color, hair color.
You can't see color because there's no color on there. But I mean, you would imagine he was probably he would, if you want to know what color he was, look at the people of that who come from that part of the world. He would have been had brown skin, and black hair. But
there is a problem here, you know, Zen, if I may interrupt rudely. There is a problem here. He was typically Semitic looking. He was Jewish for a reason. If you look at the map of the world in two dimensions, right, stretched on a page, you will see that Jerusalem comes right in the center. And I believe if a lesson was to be taught to all of us, you go right to that center to do it.
I was just going to say, the interesting thing is if you rise up into the sky, you know, onto the top of the atmosphere from Jerusalem, being in the center of the land masses of the world, actually you can see all the cities of the world from there.
You can. And so therefore, you've got a wonderful revelation here that this man was a Jew because the center of truth might have been disposed for all mankind from a geophysically relevant place, if you see what I'm trying to say. Now, if you become racist, if you become tribal, and if you begin to see people and truth based upon the complexion of a skin, I don't think you're going to get anywhere. But if you're open, and if you're sweet, and if you're generous, and if you're kind, you might get everywhere. And that's the lesson, I think, that Jesus tried to teach us, this wondrous being. And I see him as my icon, just as I see Gautama Buddha and the great prophet of Islam and all the great beings who tried to take us out of the box and teach us something away from those dark things that somehow might have been placed in us by a genetic exercise conducted by a bunch of alien machines. And that's really what I'm propounding in my books. Take a look and see. I hope that I am wrong. I truly do, for the sake of my children and yours. And let me tell you, the main target of all of this is those little ones, those innocent little ones we keep bringing into the world that have to know that they have a future. And how do we give them that if we don't look for the truth, Zen?
I fully agree with you. I have to apologize to my co-host. I haven't brought him into the show very much at all. Alan, are you still with us?
I am.
Alan, do you got a question or a comment? Because I know we're rounding down to the last 13 minutes of the show. And do you have
like to thank you gentlemen for coming on and actually just sort of opening up the paradigm into sort of a robotic mechanism and a biosynthetic android. It's, you know, I think it's expanding on what's been brought already as far as the extraterrestrial race or the contemporary view of most people that I'm aware with is sort of like a genetically engineered creature that's just supplemented as a cyborg. So I'm definitely going to take this into thought and to meditation. And, as far as Christ's bringing teachings of love, yeah, that is his primary teaching, superseded only by one, that he is the only way to heaven and that it is by faith alone and it's through his work on the cross. And I'd just like to contribute a comment on a gentleman's hope that we could take control of our planet. In my opinion, we've been trying to take control of it for the past a minimum of 6,000 years, and it's not working out too well. And just another quick comment that saying the Father of the Old Testament is devoid of love, I just believe that to be highly subjective, misconstrued comments.
You're quite right, Alan. It is highly subjective.
And it's, yeah, the Old Testament is full of Christ and prophecies of him. And I just like to comment again on the fact that the Father did an act of genocide, as some people proclaim it, that those are hybrid creatures that were not human, similar in a way to the Greys and possibly working in tandem with them. And I just wonder if you guys could comment individually on quantum mechanics and quantum physics and pointing towards, so far theoretical, but a scientific paradigm of extra-dimensional areas to our universe.
Yeah.
Multidimensionality.
Well, actually, Alan, I hope I've got where you're going, but the point is simply this. Quantum mechanics and quantum physics as such talks about, strangely, against all physics, of a union point, a singularity point, that all things that are natural come to. And Andrew has done some research on the quantum side of all of this, so Andrew would be the best to look at this.
I mean, if you, one of the most famous, notable, and founder people of quantum theory is, of course, Erwin Schrödinger. And if you read his work, it's all about talking about the nature of mind and sentient existence. And it's defining sentience as having a source outside of time and space, outside of separation, and in fact saying that fundamentally we're all one. I just want to come back to something you said, because I think it's quite dangerous to sort of think that other nationalities or groups of people or tribes or whatever of people, to assume that they're somehow different, or that they're necessarily hybrid, or and therefore expendable, and so on. I think that the people who do the killing are more likely to be like that than their victims.
Yeah. You see, the point
are
is
you
that if you, Alan, if you look at history, may I just say this, Alan? If you look at history, it's a very small gang of psychologically inept beings that got together, and because they could hit people harder on the head and took control. The vast majority of humans are not like that. They just followed, and they followed where their leaders led, and most of them paid a terrible price. Now, if you get a small number controlled and they're strategically placed, you can control an entire planet. And I think that this is what these great intelligent mechanisms, and by some great, I mean great in terms of power, intelligent mechanisms did. They got to the joints, not to the long bones. And from the joints, you need far less people to control a particular consensus. And that's what they've done, as any highly intelligent being would do. And I think that these things, these machines, are just simply following a program. Can I tell you this? They are not something evil. They don't know what evil is. They just know their program. And that's what we need to understand as human beings, that we are under the control, perhaps, of such as these. And I think that we ought not to panic. We just have to change our minds and take over again. And just as the great teacher, Christian teacher, said to them, get thee behind me, you are less than an insect because you're a machine. In fact, an insect has a derivation from the beginning of the universe. These things are made from within the universe at some kind of technological preemptive, if you like. And this problem is that they, once you program robots, and once you send them out there, we've got a big problem. And the more sophisticated they are, the more pervasive the problem. And that's really the point. Our few, you know, robots going off into space will only just take us out there, maybe, so that we can spread the discord we've done on this planet. Stephen Hawking says that that's where our future is. Really? We can't even sort out our own planet. We can't even make sure that we care for each other and care for our planet. Are we just going to be exported out there so we do the same to another planet? Will it be our gametes or whatever? I think that is an obscenity, to be honest.
The danger is that we forget what it is that makes us unique as living, sentient human beings, and we don't understand what the actually the mind is. And this is where some scientists, when they start to think in terms of cybernetics and so on, and say, yes, human beings can continue, all you need to do is upload their memory systems onto a computer chip and send it out into space. That's not you. If you just have, there's no consciousness there. There's no sentience. It's something that's made artificially. And you can see the same kind of process happening as you can imagine if some on another planet or even this one in some previous civilization, how something like the Greys could have been created.
And if I may say so, and I don't mean to flatter you, but let me tell you, you, Zen, and Alan, you're out there trying to make sense of all of this, and you are doing a service to mankind that is more powerful, I think, than many political aegises and many governments around the world. And I will wish you this much. I wish you the best of luck, old chap.
Well, we do the same. We honor you and Dr. Silverman, Dr. Bigathoff, and thank you for coming on our show. I know that we're going to have to do a follow-up to talk about and to expound upon some of these things that we've covered in this first show, but I've already got more questions than I have answers, so definitely would like to invite all of you back for a follow-up whenever you get through with your travels, Nigel, but we're down to the last 4 minutes, so I want to give you an opportunity to tell people where to go to get your books, what your website, your contact information, and that goes for all three of you.
I really don't, to be honest, and I think I'll tell you this, I really am not in this to sell my book or whatever. If they want to buy it, it's on the website. It's very simply under my name, Nigel Kerner or whatever. I'm not in this particularly to sell books or whatever. In fact, sometimes I'm accused by my peers of forgetting my publisher's name and so on. And I apologize for the actual name of the book, which was actually a publication thing, really, you know, Grey Aliens and the Harvest of Soul. It scares the living daylights of a lot of people. But the book is not really about all of that. It does come to that in the end, but I just say, if you really want to know, go and look out there in the internet. There are lots of great people who are trying to open this thing out. And the one thing that governments can't yet control is that internet. Let me tell you, we still have some freedom out there to ask people to look at this. And for me, all I do is a testament to my son, Darren, when he asked me the question, Dad, are UFOs real? It is for the future of my children that I've actually done this. No, it's no magnificent thing. It's just simply a father looking after his children. It's that simple. And I think in those terms, I think all fathers, all parents might understand that I'm actually just simply trying. I may not have all the answers. I'm the first to admit that. But take a look. I have found that we are extremely special as human beings, Jay, Zen, and you, Alan. And please take a look at what's out there. Never stop searching. The great thing is NDEs show us that maybe we have a scope beyond physical life. And that scope might mean that we have a scope into something wondrous in the future as just simple human beings. Do not be afraid of death. If you are abducted, it is because you're special, because the Greys cannot understand why they can't intercept you. Don't think that you're a victim or something terrible. You may be very, very special if you're abducted. And the great thing you have is your will to say no. Nothing can go past that. Say no. And that power of your mind will, I think, in the end, be your deliverance to the most wondrous future. If you can believe that somebody who came 2,000 years ago was saying that to all of us. It's that simple. And I think that Dr. Silverman, as a Jew, who doesn't have to, you know, announce Jesus Christ, who's kind of, you know, cornered the market by the Christian team. Remember, he was a Jew. Dr. Silverman has understood that, and maybe he can have the last.
I was just going to say, for me, Nigel's books they talk about grace, of course, but it's not really, they're not really books about grace. They're books about humanity, talking about the immense limitless potential and value of every single human being that nothing artificial can ever come close to.
And John Biggestaff, you know, we're really friends. We're not some cartel of religious nuts, really. We're just friends who got together in an ordinary way and exchanged ideas and came upon something that was absolutely wonderful. And John Biggestaff will have his day, I'm sure, talking about the actual meters of how physicality can be genetically intercepted. He's a great expert on that. So maybe you can give him the last word.
Yes, Dr. Biggestaff, final comment.
Thank you very much. I got interested in Nigel's work, and if you actually look at the sort of meat that's in the book, it poses a great number of questions to how, you know, with manipulation actually occurred. And when it comes back to the Shroud of Turin, I mean, it's an absolutely fascinating idea that you can actually unravel all of your atoms by using a sort of non-force paradigm as opposed to force to actually cause the dissolution of the tension within the atomic frame. And I've been doing some research, and I think there is an accumulating evidence to be able to explain some of these things. And this is really where my interest lies. We didn't get there in this conversation, but perhaps we can continue in a further one at some point.
Absolutely.
And we'd be delighted to take you up on your offer.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, wonderful. We will definitely be doing another show, and we'll do 2 hours, and who knows, we might have to do another one after that. We're
fair
no
enough.
Longer streaming live, but we are streaming into the archives. I'm going to give Alan final comment, and then we're going to pick up whenever you get back, Nigel, and we'll be in touch. And I thank you, all of you, and honor each of you for your opinions and your platform and for sharing your truth with us. Thank you very much.
And thanks very much, gentlemen.
Thanks,
thank you. Alan, final
comment. Yeah, on behalf of Fallen Angels TV, I'd just like to express gratitude to you gentlemen for the depth that you've brought to the conversation. Found it highly interesting. I believe there's room for a second and third show, you know, just specifically on the Greys alone. I'd love to hear about the other information and insight you have on it. And I'd like to, just invite you back for another conversation on hybrids of biblical tales and your research and where they may meet. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
We'll do that, Alan. We'll do that.